We now consider a series of selections from Plotinus' own writings as reorganized by Porphyry into the so-called Enneads. And we are looking at this from the perspective of Plotinus as spiritual guide. And that's quite legitimate. Not only was he portrayed as such, not only did he serve as such, but these texts are intended to lead people into a kind of an experience, into a sort of philosophical, we would say, contemplative spiritual practice that will get them out of the created order and into union with the divine, with the one, beyond all creation. And Plotinus begins in chapter 1 with a kind of a parable based on the familiar story of Odysseus and his flight, trying to return to his home at Ithaca after the Trojan War. Odysseus is supposed to flee from the sorceries of Circe or Calypso, but constantly to return to his own country. We are returning to what he calls Patris, the fatherland, the place, as he calls it, from which we have come. Hothen par elthomen. This is the place from which we have come. According to Plotinus, according to the Neoplatonic tradition, the soul, or the nous rather, the intellect, the part of the self that has the capacity for contemplation, was created originally pure and spiritual and has, for whatever reason, and there are various theories about this in their tradition, has fallen into the material world, and is literally a fall, and now it must get out of the material world and back into union with the divine. Well, how does that happen? Drop down to the next paragraph. He says, you must close your eyes and call upon another vision, a vision the birthright of all, but very few turn to use it. He says the soul, again this is the highlighted text, must be trained to the habit of remarking noble pursuits, then works of beauty produced not by labor of the arts, but by virtue of men known for their goodness. So virtuous actions. We are to look in the world for those who behave in a noble and virtuous way. That is what we are to regard as beautiful. And then, from the example of moral virtue, moral beauty, we are to look into the souls of these individuals that have shaped these beautiful forms and allow them for us to be a reminder of what is possible for the human person. And then he says, how are you to see into a virtuous soul and know its loveliness? With draw into yourself and look. Anage epe seauton kai ide. Withdraw within yourself and behold and look. And if you discover that you're not yet attractive, he says, act like the sculptor by cutting away here, smoothing there until a lovely face has grown. You are working on that work of art which is your own moral life, which is what you see when you look within yourself. Never cease chiseling, he says, your statue until there shall shine out from it the godlike splendor of virtue. And as we'll see, it's not only godlike, it is divine, according to Plotinus. In the last paragraph of the section before the blue line that says ecstatic vision, when you know that you have become this perfect work, self-gathered into the purity of your being. And then he talks about an experience of that true light not measured in space, not narrowed to any circumscribed form. When you perceive that you have grown to this, you have become very vision. You become sight itself. Now call up on all your confidence, strike forward yet a step. You need a guide no longer. Strain and see. So the work of spiritual guidance for Plotinus is to help the disciple, to help the other soul, to become sufficient in itself so that it can look within and engage in this meditative practice that allows it to, as he puts it, strain forward and see the truth of your eternal destiny, see the truth of who you are becoming by perfecting yourself. And below in the next section, ecstatic vision, the blue lines again are my own comments. This is from Ennead 4, section 8. Many times it has happened, lifted out of the body into myself, becoming external to all other things and self-centered, beholding a marvelous beauty both within himself and outside. acquiring identity with the divine, stationing within it, he says, moving from intellection to reasoning. So his ecstatic vision involves a perception of the divine nature itself. And then very interestingly, in 6-7, number 34, which is the next paragraph, he says that alone it may receive the alone. And we'll see that this is how the Enneads are concluded. It's a theme that comes perpetually, regularly throughout these texts by Plotinus, however they may have been rearranged. His idea that the journey to the One is a journey that is solitary. You may train the disciple, but the disciple undertakes the journey by himself. So this is a very important point of difference between Neoplatonist thought and Christian thought. In Christian thought, one is part of a communion. It is within the church that one discovers the sacraments, that one learns about God, that one discovers that the Word became flesh. God himself became communion with us. Again, very different from the Neoplatonic model of the solitary individual moving into solitary union, and perhaps the most effective contrast with this image of transcendent experience would be to compare it, as hopefully we'll have the opportunity to do during this course, with the experience of Augustine and Monica. Just before Monica's death, Augustine and his mother have this transport of ecstasy. They're sharing with each other about heaven, and as a result of their sharing, their dialogue, they have this experience of the divine. But it's together. It's a shared experience. And it occurs just before Monica's death, before she's gathered up into her heavenly reward. So within the Christian perspective, there is a much more communal awareness of the nature both of salvation and even of the nature of the ascent itself. As we'll see later in the course, there is no real role for intercession in the Neoplatonist model. But in the Christian model, of course, we are literally lifting one another up to God. For Plotinus, it is the alone to the alone. So, moving down to the next paragraph, the soul makes itself apt, beautiful to the utmost, seeing a presence suddenly manifesting within herself. And then dropping down to the next section, the blue bar, where I've indicated the phrase not theosis, which is a term which Christianity takes on. It originates or is hinted at, not this term, but the notion, as early as Irenaeus, then is particularly emphasized by St. Athanasius, the notion that salvation is by a kind of theopoiesis, a kind of divinization. God became human so that human beings might be divinized. St. Athanasius says this in his text on the Incarnation. St. Thomas Aquinas echoes it. St. Augustine says it in a kind of Eucharistic metaphor. I am, he says, speaking through the voice of Christ in the Eucharist, I am the bread of the strong. All other food you make into yourself, eat of me, and I will make you into what I am. So the Christian tradition will emphasize a transformation, a transfiguration, if you will, a kind of a real divinization as a result of salvation, but not Plotinus. Because for Plotinus, there is no need for divinization because the soul is already by its nature divine. So dropping down in 6-9 where he describes this, there only, meaning outside creation, is our true love. The soul takes another life as it approaches God. And then in the last paragraph of this little section, raised to Godhead, or better, knowing its Godhead. Knowing, the soul knowing that it is divine, all aflame then. This is the nature of the spiritual journey for Plotinus. He uses, as we'll see in the next section, and here I've included in the blue bar, in Hezukia, from the alone to the alone. The term Hezukia means quiet or stillness. It is used particularly in the later tradition of the Christian East to describe the state characterized by the soul of the individual who is practicing the Jesus prayer, seeking to be inwardly quiet, inwardly at peace through the repetition of that prayer. It acquires a technical meaning in the Christian Eastern tradition, but one finds that it is also used here by Plotinus to describe the experience of the soul moving from the alone to the alone. He says in 6:9-11, there were not two, beholder was one with the beheld. Not a vision encompassed, but a unity apprehended, a unity that was perceived. The man formed by this mingling with the Supreme must, if only he can remember, carry its image impressed upon him. He is become the unity. By this experience, you are united in a way that allows you to live differently, to be differently. No movement, no passion, once this ascent is achieved, is going to keep the individual from a constant awareness of the need to be morally pure and move constantly towards God. As if snatched up, filled with God, this individual has imperfect stillness in Hezukiah, and attained isolation, en eremo, the word that is used in the Christian context for the desert place into which Christ goes to be tempted, and then in the later monastic tradition where Saint Anthony goes. In perfect stillness, it attains, if you will, this desert isolation, being calmed, turning neither to one side nor another, utterly resting, the soul becomes utterly rest. Stasis genomenos. So there is this transformation of the self, but the self is already divine as far as Plotinus is concerned. The soul beginning to mount, dropping a couple of paragraphs down, it comes not to something alien but to its own very self. There is an ingathering, a self-gathering, he says. And finally, dropping down to the very last paragraph, which is the last part of the Enneads themselves, this is the life of gods and of the godlike and blessed among human beings. Liberation from the alien that besets us here, a life taking no pleasure in the things of earth, and finally his famous phrase, a flight of the alone to the alone, fuge monu pros monon. So there is, for Plotinus, this solitary ascent, this solitary fleeing from the world. As we've already seen, it's not a kind of a utter contempt for the loathsomeness of the body, but a leaving behind that which is unnecessary so as to get back into this primordial spiritual nature in which one was created and towards which one ultimately moves and is destined to be united. Again, the influence of Plotinus on the Christian spiritual tradition cannot be overemphasized. His language and his insights come to characterize even the spiritual vocabulary of the developing tradition. The Christian tradition, of course, is different, as we've said, as we've noted, in its emphasis on the communal nature of the movement towards God. And it's important to bear these distinctions in mind, because you can see how attractive this Neoplatonic tradition would be for the developing Christian theological and metaphysical tradition. As Christianity begins to appropriate and use the theological, philosophical language of classical antiquity, the insights of Plotinus are very attractive. Augustine himself finds them to be so, but at the same time, they are limited because there is no consecration of matter in Plotinus. There is no ultimate goodness of creation, which the Jew and the Christian would naturally affirm. So there are significant distinctions that have to be borne in mind when this language, beautiful and helpful though it is used. One has to bear in mind the distinctions and the fundamental assertions of Christianity, especially in regard to the incarnation, in appropriating and using this material.